cloudy skies at 74 degrees. Welcome to this Thursday edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Georgia Governor Nathan Deal will tour those areas affected by Hurricane Irma, mostly in north and coastal Georgia this afternoon. But still it remains, there are many people without power, and that's where we begin. We check in with Georgia Power spokesperson John Kraft. John, thanks for taking the time again.
Thanks, Rose. Glad to be here with you.
What's the latest, John? How many households or businesses are still without power?
As of 1 p.m. on Thursday here, we have about 140,000 customers remaining to get to. So we've made great progress. About 800,000 customers restored in just the first 2 days of this recovery effort.
Now, of course, when all this began, those outages were statewide. So as of right now, are there any particular areas that have a significant number of outages?
Well, sure. We are still, and we're still seeing outages across the state. But I would say Metro Atlanta still has some significant outages, as do some of the coastal counties down in southeast Georgia.
You know, we realize that much of the work is going to be centered on repairing those downed power lines. And I also understand you all were dealing with a lot of blown transformers as well. Is that the bulk of the work that's being done?
That's right. And poles, power poles, we've tallied up from our assessments, determined we have more than 1,000 power poles broken or damaged from this storm, 5,000 spans of wire down, and that equates to about 200 miles of wire that had to be restrung, and then hundreds and hundreds of transformers damaged.
Wow, John, you know, earlier in the week, another Georgia Power spokesperson cited nearly 5,500 out working. Did you all have to add more people to the crew throughout this week?
We have. We've been able to tap into additional outside resources and get them here in state. We even have some from Canada that are still on the way, and we have some from as far away as California and Washington State already working. Total workforce of about 8,000 now working to get these customers back on.
And John, here's the Moneyball question. Any idea when y'all might reach 100% restoration?
Well, we've estimated 95% by Saturday night, by late Saturday night. So we are hoping to continue making this progress we've been making. At this point in the restoration, we start moving down into the backyards and those sorts of places that are slower, but we'll keep working until we get everyone back on.
How does this relate to in terms of being able to get everyone back on to those weather events we had some few years ago, particularly the ice storms and the weather storms? How does this stack up against those events?
Right. Well, for Hurricane Matthew down just last year, less than a year ago, we had about 300 plus thousand customers out, but it was focused southeast Georgia. We had the ice storm a few years ago, central Georgia north all the way to the top. That, I think, was 700,000. With this storm, we had every county in Georgia affected with up to 1 million customers out. So this is certainly among the largest we've ever seen.
And, John, the question that I ask every Georgia Power spokesperson, what's your advice to those who unfortunately are still without electricity?
Right. Well, we certainly understand how inconvenient that is, and we really appreciate their patience. We're getting some great comments on our social media channels from people who are very understanding of the work underway. We appreciate that patience. Please still stay away from any wires that might be down in your area, and don't worry that we are coming. We're working.
All right, John Kraft, spokesperson for Georgia Power. Hey, John, thanks for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Glad to do it. Thank you.
Meanwhile, as those efforts to restore power are still ongoing, several area school districts had to cancel classes this week. We know APS did, Fulton, Clayton, and Gwinnett. Well, they're all back, except for one local area school, and that is DeKalb County. And joining me now for an update is DeKalb County Superintendent, Dr. Stephen Green. Dr. Green, thanks for taking the time.
Pleasure to be here.
Let's begin with an assessment check. Were there any of the schools in your district that suffered any damage?
Yes, we did have some damage due to trees that had fallen down, but that wasn't the major problem. I think we were able to get those trees removed rather quickly, but then we had other challenges with regard to power outage and roof leaks and other kinds of things. But I'm pleased to say that we're well on the road to recovery. We've been moving at warp speed, and with the assistance of Georgia Power, we are in a good position now, much better than we were even yesterday.
So currently, how many schools remain without power or offices in the district?
Well, we were 32 yesterday, and we're down to single digits. About seven schools without power, and we have a timeline for when those schools are going to have their power restored. So we're in a much better position. We started out, if you recall, at 62 at one point. That amounts, and the 23 that were the 32 yesterday were, you know, that amounts to about 23,000 students being impacted.
And I understand you were all out looking. You were out looking at schools today. What was your, I guess, takeaway from what's taken place so far?
Well, yeah, I did. I started from the south and then moved north and went to see several different schools, from Southwest DeKalb High School to the International Student Center to Kittredge Magnet and to Columbia High School. And I was pleased to see the pace with which the work was going on. In some cases, some of the things that I expected to see had already been remedied by the time I'd gotten there. And so I was pleased to see that. But we do still have some areas that are hot spots that we need to address, down power lines that, as was referred to by Mr. Kraft, that pose a hazard if they're coming from a building and dipping down to eye level or waist level because of the trees falling on them. But we're going to get that removed, and I'm very optimistic that we'll be able to move forward with the opening of school on Friday.
On Friday. That also means, you know, Friday night in Georgia in September, football. So that's the question everybody wants to know, Dr. Green. Can they play ball tomorrow?
Yeah, I think we're going to be able to go forward with that. I still have to confer with my team and get all the specifics, but I have my early indication is that it's likely that we'll be able to proceed with the Friday night football.
Now, I'm sure there's some student in DeKalb County saying, Roscott, please ask him this. Why not just start school on Monday?
Well, I mean, the goal is to, when we can, do what we can. And so so it looks like we're going to be in a favorable position. So why delay? On one sense, there was a sense of urgency to do as best we could and be safe about that. And so safety has been the guiding principle. I was willing to trade a day yesterday, and I think a day has made a difference. And today, to get make sure that our buildings are safe and the transit is safe. And so now it's time to get busy.
All right. And as for tomorrow, when should parents know if classes are going to be resuming?
We'll meet as a administrative team at 1:30 today, and pull all the notes together and all the information that we have together, and make a final decision, and I'll share that with the board, and then we'll move forward from there. So they will know probably around 3 o'clock, 3:30, 3 o'clock today, they will know.
All right, DeKalb County Superintendent Dr. Stephen Green with an update. Thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Support for WABE comes from Northside Drive Baptist Church, hosting speaker Dr. David Shai, educator and author specializing in intellectual and cultural history, on the pursuit of happiness, September 17th at 4 p.m., northsidedrive.org. Support for WABE comes from Ackerman Security, providing custom-designed smart home security systems with remote access as well as video surveillance, fire protection, and monitored entry alarms to protect your home and business. Ackerman, the sign of real security.
And Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. Look around. It seems just about everywhere there's new development or redevelopment underway. You can even find not one but two construction sites right outside our public broadcast in Atlanta studios. So it may seem strange that there's a shortage of skilled workers within the state's construction industry. Now, that was the finding from a recent survey from Autodesk and the Associated General Contractors of America. So, what do? We called up Mike Dunham. He's the CEO of the Associated General Contractors of Georgia. And we invited him over to the neighborhood. We sat down outside in front of a construction site where a new subdivision is being built. And we talked about the state's construction labor shortage. Let's begin with this. How long have you been involved with the construction industry?
Well, I started my career straight out of college working for the association. joined the AGC back in 1981, so I've been around for 36 years, managing a small chapter in Monroe, Louisiana, and then moved down to Jacksonville for 6 years, but been running this chapter of AGC since 1995.
After the Great Recession, the construction industry was being touted as making an incredible rebound. To your knowledge, how long did it take Georgia to bounce back?
Well, Georgia's sort of fortunate. We have the hub of the South in Atlanta. Georgia's blessed with a coastline and a great port. Construction's one of the first industries that will fall off during a recession. It also will lead back the recovery. There's always a pent-up demand for construction. There's infrastructure that needs to be repaired. We've got, of course, in this city, it's no surprise, we've got a lot of highway construction going on. So as construction will lead into the recession, it also will lead out of a recession.
So in general, the construction business here in Georgia is pretty solid.
We're very blessed here in the state of Georgia, particularly around our economic hubs of Atlanta, Augusta, Macon, Savannah. We do have other parts of the states that don't enjoy quite the robust economy, and I know that's being addressed by a lot of people in our state government and in our business leaders.
Are you talking about rural communities?
That's correct. Rural communities that don't have the economic hub of industry, they may not be on the pathways of 95 or 75 or 85. When they're off the beaten path, so to speak, they do have a challenge.
Were you surprised then at the findings of this survey? I mean, it was 70% of construction firms reported they have a hard time filling positions.
Well, no, not really. What happened during the recession is a lot of people left our industry. They went out to find different careers, and so we had this exodus of our industry during the recession. Secondly, what's happened during this recession, a lot of our workers got older. We've got a pretty big exodus of our skilled workforce just because of the aging of our population. For every 4 to 5 people that leave the industry, we're only finding ourselves replacing them with one person. And you can just see that trend just can't sustain itself. So one of the big things we're doing right now is we're trying to show young men and women that there's a real career in construction, not just a job, but a career.
And we're going to talk more about that in just a moment, but something that I noticed was that this shortage was in what's labeled hourly craft positions. What are we talking about?
Your carpenters, your laborers, your masons, your plumbers, your electricians, just about every skilled trade that actually goes on the job site and does the construction, we're short. We need more people in that world.
Let's talk about possible reasons for the shortage. You talked about an aging workforce and not being able to replenish that, but let's talk about the pipeline factor, because traditionally, what's the path into construction work?
Unfortunately, I think we went through several generations of everyone must go to college. That was the mindset in our schools. Everyone needs to go to college, which is just not true. Out of every 10 students, only 3 will actually pursue and receive a 4-year degree. 7 will not. And it's those 7 that we should be helping get through this, what we call our K-12 pipeline. They should be able to come through high school, get a skill, get a trade, be job ready. If they want to move on into the vocational trade programs through our technical college system of Georgia, we should have that ready and waiting for them. And we also have apprenticeship programs and on-the-job training, a lot of different ways to enter our industry.
Well, if we have all these initiatives and we have all these pathways into the construction industry, is it simply that maybe the industry needs to do a better job of attracting that pipeline at a younger age?
Oh, absolutely. I tell my membership at AGC, this is our problem. No one will fix this for us but us. And we're challenging our membership to get out into the classrooms, go to their local schools, meet those instructors, support them in what they're trying to do, be there to tell the students about this career opportunity. And the one thing that I always hear from instructors that they're looking for is someone to come talk to their students. So we have a great story. We've got a great industry. We've got great opportunity for the future. We just need to get out and tell our story.
In terms of telling that story, are you also targeting a diverse population to enter the workforce? For example, more women, more minorities, more veterans, those who are re-entering society after being incarcerated?
That's the great thing about the construction industry. It is open to everybody of all walks of life, regardless of whether they're coming out of the military or coming out of our penal institutions and needing a second chance. Leading this effort is going to take everybody, and we need everybody. And so the diversity of our workforce is critically important to us, and we just simply need to work with all the different systems of our schools and our institutions of higher learning, like the technical college systems. And of course, we have outreach to the veterans every day.
As you drive around the Atlanta area or Georgia and you see all this construction, I mean, you're talking to me right in front of some major development here across the street. So we know that the jobs are there. So is it a little just disheartening saying, okay, how do we get more people to be out there doing what these guys and women are doing right now?
You know, a student can't choose a construction career if he doesn't know about it. And so their exposure to our industry is one of the critical first steps. Then when they find out that they have a skills aptitude or an interest in it, then we can help them get to where they want to be and what they want to be involved in. In fact, our state of Georgia has just entered into an agreement to offer the students of our high school programs a aptitude tool called U-Science that we're extraordinarily excited about, because U-Science will help students discover where their interests lie and what they're good at, what their aptitudes are, and help the counselors and the parents understand that and get students directed in this direction.
Is it panic mode right now in Georgia's construction industry if the workforce keeps declining?
It's concerning, but let me tell you, contractors are the most creative people I've ever known, and they see what has to be done, they understand what it's going to take, and they just work to work around those problems, those challenges. Now, for the owners, you have to understand, it's one of those basic supply and demand things that they teach you early on in school, supply and demand. We're going to have a very low supply of labor. That means the labor that's out there is going to be more expensive, and it's going to cost the cost of construction to go up. And I think probably one of the other things that you have to adjust to is something that might take 12 months to build might now take 16 months.
But could this also prevent contractors from bidding on projects here in the state? And then might we see outside companies from neighboring states who have the labor workforce come in and bid on those projects?
Certainly one of the limiting factors on a contractor's ability to pursue work right now is his available labor. There are many contractors who know there's opportunities, they have the capacity monetarily and bonding, but they're just not going to pursue that work unless they know they have the people to do it. And that's the quickest way to get yourself in trouble. So yes, it is having an impact. Would contractors from out of state pursue work if they have the available labor? Again, that's that ebb and flow of opportunity that exists. If you can maintain and control your labor force and have available labor to provide, then you are going to be in a better position to pursue work. So yes, I would say right now, almost everyone in the industry is being very selective in what they pursue, and what they're doing is not to overextend themselves. That's the quickest way to get in trouble.
So then what can you all do for your general contractors here? You know, you talked about the initiatives and you said it's concerning, but it's not panic mode yet. So what are you all doing?
Well, it's a multi-pronged attack, so to speak. It's a ground up. And I call it ground up, and that's getting into the high schools. And that's a 12-year project. That's starting off with a kindergartner and going all the way up through 12th grade and getting them to see our industry. So that's a long-term approach to addressing an issue. We didn't get to where we are today with a shortage. We're not going to get out of it in a single day. For the immediate problem, many contractors are just having to address it, understanding that they're going to have to be putting in overtime. They're going to have to address their workforce. Hours are going to extend. So for the existing worker, there's that opportunity for greater employment and gain of monetary reward, because there's going to be a lot of demand for the ones that are out there. So contractors are having to address this. They're being very aggressive in, as you say, looking for military, or recruiting people straight out of high school immediately and trying to put them on jobs early. And so contractors are very resourceful, and they're looking to do the workaround.
When it comes to training initiatives, do you think that there's more that could be done, though?
Oh yeah, we have a lot of opportunity. Our initiatives from the ground up is to get into high schools. From the top down, we're working with all levels of government, the governor's office, the lieutenant governor's office, the technical college systems, the Department of Education, to try to get more money into CTAE training here in the state of Georgia. Again, go back to the 7 students that will not go for a 4-year institution. We need to put more money into the craft training opportunities and the skilled trades that would help them be job ready. So we need to address that politically and put our resources at a point that we're helping those 7 students be that much better prepared to enter the job market.
How do you address that politically?
It's one of the challenges that when you work inside a system that has a change of leadership is that you're there to educate. The meetings that we have, the opportunities to sit down with the leadership and to constantly keep this focused, keep addressing it. And yes, we will have a pretty significant turnover in all levels of government in this next election. So all our constitutional offices are up for election. Well, whoever comes into those offices, we will immediately sit down with them and lay out the concern that our industry and many industries have that we need more skilled trade people in the marketplace.
So you all will not endorse a candidate, let's say for governor, you'll wait and see who gets elected and then have those meetings?
We have not as an industry endorsed anyone. We do know who our friends are. We do know who we need to support. It's important that we have people that are pro-business and understand our industry, take a leadership role in government, and we do support them. And we're here as an educational source. We're here to be a resource to everyone because we know our industry better than anybody else. And so when you have people from all walks of life that come in, I tell people, I get to speak to high school sometimes, talk to civic classes. You have people that are pharmacists and farmers and stay-at-home moms and insurance agents. They all know their career or where they're coming from very well. That's where they grew up, but they don't know my industry. So part of our job as an association is to be there as a resource and to educate those people about our needs and those issues that help us and those issues that might hurt us and make them aware.
As we wrap up, the growth or decline of Georgia's construction industry does impact other industries. Now, coming up after this segment, we're going to talk about the aerospace manufacturing industry here in Georgia, which is doing quite well. But you say you all are connected to that, so to speak.
I like to tell all my friends and all the other industries, manufacturing, aerospace, even the film industry. If you look around the state of Georgia and these large studios that have been built, they can't film the first movie until we build their studios. So construction is sort of the foundation of all the growth of our economy, because without those expansions of the plants or those developments of new buildings like the film industry have put in, our aerospace friends that have to build their plants and their manufacturing concerns, construction will lead the way. We'll be there first to build what they need to have, and we'll maintain it for them.
So basically, Georgia goes as construction goes?
I like to think that way myself.
Mike Dunham, Chief Executive Officer, Associated General Contractors of Georgia. Thanks for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Support for WABE comes from Comcast Business. Comcast is building a gig speed network providing small businesses across the country with the opportunity to dream gig. Learn more at dreamgig.com. Comcast Business, built for business. And from Atlanta Chamber Players, presenting their opening concert on September 17th at St. Dunstan's Episcopal Church. Concert features a celebration of Beethoven with an all-star cast of ASO musicians. AtlantaChamberPlayers.com.
The haves and the have-nots see an even starker divide in Florida after Hurricane Irma.
Naples usually gets everything first, and then I guess we get the hand-me-downs from them.
I'm Kelly McEvers, also President Trump's first visit to the state after the storm, on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
From 4 to 6:30 on 90.1 WABE.
Yeah. And Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. As always, I'm Rose Scott. You just heard that conversation with Mike Dunham, CEO of the Associated General Contractors of Georgia, talking about the state construction worker shortage. Well, now we're going to turn our attention to another industry that's doing quite well, aerospace manufacturing. But first, take a listen to this.
7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Smoke. This is from the August 3rd Vector Space Systems Vector R rocket launch from the Camden Spaceport in Georgia. It was posted on YouTube. Now, chances are some part or system software that made this rocket was manufactured right here in the state. According to the Georgia Department of Economic Development, Georgia's aerospace manufacturing industry has a huge impact, not just in the state, not just nationwide, but globally as well. In fact, PricewaterhouseCooper has named Georgia the top state for aerospace manufacturing. Who knew, and how long has this been going on? Well, joining me with the answers is Karen Hudnall. She's the director of the Center of Innovation for Aerospace. Karen, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Who knew? Who knew? When did all this happen?
Well, aerospace has been a powerhouse in Georgia for a long time. We're blessed with a unique mix of educational facilities and industries here that have created a vibrant aerospace community. Our industry is worth about $64 billion, and it's roughly evenly divided between manufacturing, maintenance, repair, and overhaul, and air transportation, with two emerging sectors in unmanned aircraft systems and space, like Vector.
The way I came into the segment with the who knew, do you get that a lot?
We do. We hear that a lot. And when people say aerospace, they don't always think of the breadth of the industry that we have here. Everything from the people that are cleaning aircraft at Hartsfield-Jackson to the PhDs in aerospace at Georgia Tech doing research for NASA.
How many aerospace manufacturing companies are we talking about here? Hundreds?
Hundreds. Georgia Power has a great report on aerospace manufacturing that says there's about 300. We say there's about 800 companies overall. I would guess that there's 300 plus in manufacturing.
So what's driving this boom, though, that's been happening? Is it just that Georgia has this platform, this location to accommodate the plants? I mean, why Georgia?
Well, globally, aerospace is growing hugely as countries develop and have more economic wherewithal. They're able to travel by air. Our logistics industry here in Georgia is huge. Air cargo is huge. And as that global demand increases, Georgia has been responding with growth here in the state.
So you're talking about the airport, and you're also talking about the Savannah port. All that is connected.
Absolutely. It's one integrated logistics system.
When we talk about products, can you give our listeners some examples of what's being produced here? Where they could say, oh, okay, I get it. I know what that is.
Okay, so if we talk about big aircraft, entire aircraft, we have Lockheed Martin Aeronautics here in Marietta. We have Gulfstream in Savannah. We have Thrush creating agricultural aircraft and Mall. And then we have major component manufacturers like Eaton Aerospace, Honeywell, Meggitt, Pratt & Whitney. And then we have a lot of parts manufacturing and specialty machining.
Is this spread out throughout the entire state?
Throughout the state. We have four large clusters here in Atlanta, in Columbus, in Macon, Warner Robins, and down in Savannah. But we also have large aerospace companies up in Athens, in Augusta. So it's around the state.
And I understand that because the demand is so large, but we're exporting, so our customers are around the globe.
Yes, aerospace, aircraft and aircraft parts are actually the number one international export of the state of Georgia. We did $7.9 billion last year, and it has been the number one export since 2004. So you hear a lot about peaches and poultry and peanuts.
Now, I have a very good peach farmer down in South Georgia. He's my buddy, you know.
Y'all, you hear a lot about peaches and poultry and peanuts, but I'm here to tell you it's planes and parts. And those exports have grown 111% since 2004.
Before this segment, and we were talking about the construction worker shortage in the construction industry in the state, how is aerospace doing? Are you all looking pretty good in terms of that pipeline and keeping that workforce steady?
So aerospace, it's also experiencing the aging issue that he was talking about. So aerospace is aging out. We need more people to come into the aerospace industry. These are good paying jobs. We just completed an economic impact study, and the average aerospace jobs in the state without benefits is about 72,000. That's 47% higher than the state's average wages of 49,000. So aerospace jobs are good jobs, and they really cover the gamut. You can be a machinist, you can be an engineer, you can be somebody that's buying fuel for Delta. So somebody with an interest in training.
So in that construction worker shortage segment, we talked about initiatives to improve that pipeline, increase the pipeline. He talked about that starting as early as K-12. Where do you all see beginning to recruit and get more people interested?
We see this as a big need, and the governor's High Demand Career Initiative also has an aerospace task force, and where we're partnering with partners like Delta, Lockheed Martin, Gulfstream, looking at the needs. The initial task was looking at aviation maintenance technicians and pilots, where we're seeing a big shortage. That's a shortage globally. The Boeing forecast is that globally we're going to need 650,000 pilots and an equal number of aviation maintenance technicians between now and 2035.
Is the aging process, not being able to replenish those who are retiring or moving on, is that the number one reason, you think?
So a couple of reasons on the pilot side. The airline industry is cyclical, so during the recession, they weren't doing any hiring, so they were holding on. People were stagnant. They weren't really hiring. But there's contributing factors like the military is no longer producing as many pilots. We're moving towards unmanned aircraft systems. And so those pilots coming out of the military, which has traditionally been a big source for the airlines, is slowing down. Luckily, here in the state, we have great educational components. We have four high schools right now teaching aviation curriculum, the Georgia aviation curriculum, that again, we were part of bringing together the university system, the technical college system, and industry partners to write that curriculum. Next year, in 2018, we will have 11 schools and college and career academies teaching aviation programs.
So. Does that give you a little bit of hope in terms of the future? That timeline, does that help? I mean, is that a significant help in terms of, you know, increasing the number of people going into the industry?
I think, like the gentleman ahead of me said, if people don't know that this is an option, they don't think I'm going to do that. And on the aviation maintenance technician side, we have five technical colleges that are offering FAA certificated programs, and everything from aircraft structures up through aviation maintenance technician, airframe, and power plant. At Savannah Tech, they're even doing some custom things for Gulfstream to support Gulfstream. So they have airline upholstery and specialty cabinet making for Gulfstream interiors that they're offering at Savannah Tech. And they're even teaching one of those programs in a local high school with a dual enrollment plan.
Are there initiatives targeting women or veterans or those who were formerly incarcerated? Any initiatives to target those folks?
So yes, they recognize that, they recognize that there is a shortage overall, and their traditional methods aren't going to create enough people for these jobs. So yes, they're really trying to reach out.
You mentioned that there are so many jobs and people don't really quite understand that aerospace industry is this broad term. So what can you all do better to get the word out? I mean, you mentioned partnering and that's great, but Do you work with the Department of Labor at all? Do you say, hey, Commissioner, we've got these jobs, and we keep, you know, depending on whom you ask, the Georgia's unemployment rate, you know, mm-hmm. the number, it fluctuates depending on, you know, who's actually crunching the numbers. So have you reached out to them? Do you have a partnership that says, hey, we have these jobs? Let people know.
Absolutely. The Workforce Division at the Georgia Department of Economic Development is our focal point for those efforts. Absolutely.
What's your job?
So I'm the director of the Center of Innovation for Aerospace, and the Centers of Innovation are focused on six strategic industries within the state. So it's agribusiness, aerospace, advanced manufacturing, logistics, IT, and energy.
Now, earlier you heard Mike say, look, nothing can really take off in this state without construction starting first. So, but what's your response in terms of the aerospace industry? If not that you all are going to go down the tubes, but if those numbers in terms of the labor workforce continue to decline, what's the consequence? Did I scare you with that question?
No, that's just daunting, right, to think about. No, you know, you see what happens is that airlines have to cancel flights because they don't have the people to fly and operate the aircraft or to maintain them. I mean, it's just it continues to affect the industry across all of the jobs.
I'll put the same question to you that I put earlier. Are you all in crisis mode over this? Are you worried or is it panic mode?
So I think one thing that is I would say we are up against a labor shortage. We're looking at shortages that the industry is facing. The silver lining of that is that industry is ready to partner. So people are coming together instead of just worrying about their own piece of the pie. They're starting to look at it and say, how can we collaborate to grow the pie and grow the workforce for all of us?
And so throughout all of this, the states that are number 2, 3, 4, and 5, they're going, hey, well, if Georgia has a labor shortage, you know, maybe we could come in, maybe we can pull some of those contracts that these companies have. Is that a concern for you?
No, I'm not concerned about that.
You're not concerned about state number 2.
I'm not. Georgia, we have a lot of advantages here in Georgia, and I'm pretty confident that you'll see that we have expansions, a lot of recent expansions. Companies like Meggitt mm-hmm. Composites has just announced an expansion. They're going to bring in an additional 200 jobs and $30 million of investment into Rockmart. Pratt & Whitney just added 500 jobs and is putting $380 million into Columbus, their facility. So we're seeing continued growth, continued companies to come here.
And what about those incentives? How great are those for those companies?
I can't really speak to incentives. My job is to focus on the companies that are already here in Georgia or that have locations, and we provide technical support to those companies to help them grow organically. So I'm on the organic side of economic development, growing what we have here.
You got out of that question very well.
I just don't want to speak out of my swim lane. I can connect you to Mike Grundman at the Department of Economic Development,
Mike on the line.
Who runs right, aerospace.
This summer, Governor Nathan Deal signed this Georgia Space Flight Act into law. What is this all about?
Well, I think that the Georgia Space Flight, if you bring it down to the basics, it basically says if you ride on a rocket, you understand that this is inherently a dangerous activity. What it really does is it's trying to, you know, show the liability mm-hmm. and help people understand that Georgia is open for space business.
But you all would want to see more of these space flight startup companies? I mean, it's all part of aerospace, so.
It's all part of aerospace, and we have a phenomenal foundation here to grow the space industry. You know, traditionally, space has been
It's the final frontier.
Well, it is. So space has been in states like Florida where they mm-hmm. have NASA. They
sure.
have federal installations that are focused on space or military installations. Georgia hasn't had those. But what we have had is we have the great education system. Mm-hmm. We have Georgia Tech producing more aerospace engineers than any other school in the country. And because we're moving from government space towards commercial space, mm-hmm. now Georgia's entrepreneurial skill set is coming into play, and we're able to take advantage of that. So we have companies like Generation Orbit that mm-hmm. is launching small. We have several big satellite companies like Intelsat and Viasat. So we have a small space presence, but we're ready to grow with the opportunities that commercial space is going to offer us.
Speaking of growing, as we wrap up, tell me where you see the aerospace industry in this state in the next 5 years.
I think we'll continue to grow. We're projecting that the aerospace industry will continue to grow about 6% until 2021. That's as far out as the studies have gone. But with increased demand globally and with our ability to produce, I think that the aerospace industry will continue to soar here in Georgia.
Continue to soar. Did I tell you to say that?
No.
Amy Hutnall, the director of the Center of Innovation for Aerospace, and we've been talking about Georgia's aerospace manufacturing industry. Thank you so much for coming and taking the time.
Thank you.
Good
very
conversation.
Much for having us.
Did you miss some of today's interview? Don't worry. Catch each day's show at wabe.org/closerlook. Also, we want to hear from you. Send our host, Rose Scott, an email at rose@wabe.org. This is 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR.
And you're listening to Closer Look here on Atlanta's Choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. You know, when this program began back in 2015, one of the first places producer Candace Wheeler and I agreed we needed to do a story on was a Peachtree Pine homeless shelter. And we spent about, what, Candace, 6-7 hours in there? And inside we met Anthony. He was in charge of the rooftop garden.
It did help you out a lot, you know. Calmed down a lot and everything. And it basically helped me get my life back together. And everything, you know, I got my GED, my high school diploma, and when I turned around and went and got my get certified through agriculture and everything, that could do nothing but put a smile on my face.
And as you know, the doors to Peachtree Pine Homeless Shelter are officially closing now. The Metro Atlanta Task Force for the Homeless had been operating the building that sits on the corners of Peachtree and Pine Streets. Now, for years, we all know the shelter had been at the center of controversy and legal negotiations. There were concerns about safety inside and around the shelter, criminal activity taking place outside the shelter, and whether or not the homeless were receiving enough and adequate resources. Well, we're going to revisit a conversation we just had with Carl Hartramp. He's the executive director of the Metro Atlanta Task Force for the Homeless, and he has been volunteering with the shelter since the 80s. Our conversation began, and I asked him to think about what to think about what Anthony just said.
Well, first of all, it brings back a lot of memories. I really enjoyed working with Anthony, and the roof garden has been a real gem of the Peachtree Pine Task Force location. And we're going to continue that at our new location. But just listening to the men that have been there, and particularly that clip, think about all the great memories we had and all the good work we did.
So physically, the place will not be the same, but you are transitioning in terms of to another facility?
Yes, we're leaving the building. We've already officially left the building. Mm-hmm. The men are still there, and we're transitioning some of the men in our RV program, resident volunteer program, and the transition program to another facility, and we're moving our administrative offices to the west side. And we have plans to put two new gardens, urban farms, in place and train the men that want to participate in that with Rashid Nuri at the Truly Living Well farm to in that same program that Anthony mentioned. We have currently one young man that's with us now that has a full-time job at Truly Living Well that went through that program. So we have a lot of good ideas and new ideas. It's just sad to be leaving our home at Peachtree and Pine.
Carl, you say it's sad to be leaving. When you look back, was there anything that you all as the entity operating this shelter that you all could have done differently, that maybe the outcome wouldn't have gotten to where it is now?
No, I think if you look at it in the overall sense of the development and growth of Atlanta, we not only have a growing homeless problem, which all urban communities have, and that's in dispute, but we also have a growing hospitals around us, the apartment complexes, the condominiums around us. They just didn't want us to be there.
We've all driven down past that building. You see the numerous amounts of people outside of there. There were issues about crime, criminal activity. Can you understand that?
Oh, well, there's always reasons and issues that people that move into a community want to change. Mm-hmm. And so we're not even debating that. We understand that issue. We ask for help from the police department to clean that up, and because those men and women that were hanging on the streets were not part of our clientele. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there was some debate about that, but I can understand the image, and we frankly feel that was used against us to put more pressure on us to leave.
On a given night, how many people stayed at the shelter?
Well, it fluctuates. Mm-hmm. On a warm night in the summer, we may have 250, 300 men and women and children. On a cold night in the winter, we would have up to 1,000 people in the building.
Producer Candace Wheeler and I, we spent hours and hours inside Peachtree Pine Shelter. It was in desperate need of repair, and a lot of folks volunteered to come help y'all out. There was a outbreak of TB, as you know, as well. Did you just not have enough funding to also keep the building, the facility up as well? And did funding dwindle over the years because of all the other issues and the perception?
Yes, we had a master plan to redevelop the building to make it sustainable, green, water. We're going to harvest on rainwater. And we had it fully budgeted and fully estimated by a contractor. We were at the same time receiving great pressure to move, and our funding was reduced over the years. And so we basically ended up losing all of our federal and state money and relied only on those truly dedicated private individuals that wanted to continue to give us money, mainly to just exist. All we could do is pay our utilities and pay some of the supplies and minor repairs.
Why was your funding reduced on the federal and local level?
Well, again, it was that the city wanted us to move, and so the city exerted great pressure on us through their grants department to cut our city, state, and federal funding. And that was part of the discussion and the legal battles that we had with the city and other people was about how that funding was cut off and how we needed it to survive.
Moving forward to the new location, I imagine there are some lessons learned from all the years at Peachtree Pine that you all can look at and use as a template for not to do moving forward. If so, what are they?
Well, first, we're not going to open an emergency overflow shelter. We have actually negotiated in our settlement agreement that the United Way and the City of Atlanta will work together to open additional shelters. And so we're going to be monitoring that and making sure that happens, and we'll at the same time be delivering services to our same client base and the client new clients that come to us from those shelters or from the street. So we're going to continue our role as advocates, mm-hmm. and we're going to create some job training programs, but we're not going to be operating an emergency shelter right off the bat.
But will you still have some residential intake? You'll be able to do that process that you used to do at Peachtree Pine?
Yes, we will continue to receive clients and refer them to housing, and also we will maintain our transitional and volunteer program.
When we think of settlement, we think of dollars. Were you all able to receive a satisfactory amount to help you with this transition?
Again, that's confidential,
sure.
The amount is, but we did, after we paid all our debts, we did receive enough funding to continue our mission.
And what about being good stewards of the neighborhood for your new location?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's one thing we're very concerned about, working with the neighborhood, and we are right now negotiating with a landlord on the west side to begin our operations there, close to the Jefferson Place shelter that's going to open, so mm-hmm. we'll have access to our client base and the Good Samaritan Clinic, where a lot of our clients go. And we'll also be working with neighbors in the area on our jobs program and our urban farming program.
We've asked this question so many times in terms of affordable housing. I'm going to ask you about Atlanta's homeless crisis. Is it at a crisis? Is it at an epidemic?
We believe it's a crisis, and we think the four main causes. One is the lack of affordable housing. I mean, that's just the problem that's existed for years, and it's getting worse. I mean, you can't an individual that makes a minimum wage cannot afford a one-bedroom apartment.
You mentioned there are people who have full-time jobs.
Oh, yes.
They rely on the shelter.
That are in the shelter with full-time jobs because they can't ever save enough to make a deposit or utility payment. The second thing that we realize is, again, the lack of affordable wages. In other words, you can't maintain a household on a minimum wage. You have to have even two people on minimum wage can't maintain a household, pay child care, pay for all the services. So the lack of living wage jobs is another issue. And the third is that we have a system in place, and the DACA guest before mentioned that, it's a criminalization of poverty and race. And so we have built-in institutional discrimination that creates obstacles for people to maintain their homes or achieve their own independent living. And then finally, of course, is the medical and health care issues. Though that is some of the one, it keeps people in homelessness, but also it forces people into homelessness.
And Carl, as we wrap up, because I want to touch on what you just said, that fourth factor, which is medical, and particularly with mental health conditions, how are you all prepared to address that? Do you have partners that you can refer people to when they come in? Because you can't serve everybody. They may have conditions or needs that you all just can't meet.
Right. We have a direct relationship partnership with the Good Samaritan Clinic. We also have a very good relationship with the Fulton County Department of Health. And so we make referrals constantly to other health providers. And we have on staff a full-time drug counselor that makes referrals to rehab.
You've been involved with this shelter, with the mission for a long time. Why do you do this?
Well, it goes back to my background in housing and development. When I was just out of law school, I was actually renovating houses in Virginia Highlands. And I realized that as I renovated those houses in Virginia Highlands, I was decreasing the supply of affordable housing. And so I knew I had to put something back in the system because I was making money, you know, improving the system, but I was depleting the system on the bottom. So to me, it's a cycle. It's an engine that needs to be developed, and we're way behind. I mean, we've been working this for a long time, and we haven't solved it yet.
Carl Hartrump, Executive Director of the Metro Atlanta Task for the Homeless. We've been talking about the closing of the Peachtree Pine shelter at that location, but also transitioning to a new location. Carl, thanks for coming in and taking the time. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you for your time, too.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The lead role in The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime is a character with autism. And for the first time, it's being played by an actor with autism.
I knew that the train station was somewhere near, and if something is nearby, you can find it by moving in a spiral, walking clockwise, and taking every right turn until you come back to a road you've already walked on.
That's next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon at 3 on 90.1 WABE.
Are you tired of that car that won't start? Why not donate it to WABE and support the programs that you enjoy? Learn more about WABE's vehicle donation program at wabe.org/cars or call 1-866-901-WABE. And thanks.
That's it for today's show. Closer Look, of course, is produced by Candace Wheeler, Ebony Lemon, and Finley Foxen. Our engineer is Elizabeth Eads. Our executive producer is Christine Dempsey. And a special thanks to the WABE News team, as well as our digital services crew. Now, some of y'all are tweeting and sending emails asking about information on those jobs that we just talked about. Well, we'll have that information on our website shortly. If you missed any of today's show, you can find the entire program at wabe.org/closerlook. You can always listen to Closer Look weeknights at 9 p.m. We're back tomorrow at 1 for another edition of Closer Look. Stay tuned to 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott.